All right, here we are with Brandon Malone, Policy Manager at Paradigm. Brandon, it's so great to have you on the Defiant podcast.
Thanks, Camila. Super excited to be here.
Yeah, so you're leading policy at one of crypto's biggest, most recognized venture capital firms. And, you know, we were just discussing that, you know, how I think it's so interesting that your job basically exists. The fact that a VC has a policy arm or a policy effort, you know, as part of its, you know, ongoing work. So if we can just start by laying the grounds on, you know, what you actually do and why that's needed in crypto.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm one member of a relatively small team. There are about 5 to 7 folks who cover policy at Paradigm. A few folks operate more in a legal capacity, but also spend quite a bit of their time focused on policy issues. And collectively, we work on a number of things. Part of our job involves advising small portfolio companies. And here, I think it's really important for all companies that are building to be aware of the overall policy landscape, and in particular, regulatory issues that might be relevant for their businesses. That said, it's not always the case that in the early stages of a startup's life cycle, they can really justify spending the time and resources to have their own dedicated policy team. So, for example, for companies that are kind of pre-product market fit, mostly technical engineering hires, it doesn't always make sense for them to hire a person in Washington, D.C. or in a capital outside the U.S. focused exclusively on policy issues. And you know, we feel like bundling that in a venture capital fund gives us the ability to provide some of those services to early stage startups so that they don't necessarily have to spend too many other resources doing things other than building the best products. And given you know, the crypto space in general is full of challenges on the technical side, we really want to create pathways for them to focus most of their resources and attention on those matters that are critically important. In addition to supporting our companies, we also spend a lot of time trying to improve the overall policy landscape for crypto by thought leadership and research, in addition to legal advocacy that we think can, over time, help educate policymakers and eventually reshape the policy landscape in a way that's productive for the industry as a whole. That is kind of one of the founding beliefs behind the Policy Lab, which we launched about 6 weeks ago.
Perfect. And before we get into you know, some of the policies that you're advocating for, that you've researched, would be great to talk a bit about your background. So you come from working at the Fed, and you know, like you mentioned, it does seem like a polar opposite to crypto. So what was your experience there, and how was that transition like? Like, what prompted you to make the jump?
Yeah, definitely. I sometimes get eye rolls when I mention that I worked at the Fed for 7 years before joining a crypto company. But honestly, I was interested in crypto before joining the Fed, discovered Bitcoin in graduate school in 2013, was flirting with an economics PhD and thought that I would become an econ professor. Over time, I realized that like wasn't really a good match for my skill set or interest, and wanted to do something that was a little more practical and more hands-on, and thought at the time that I could get a job at a crypto company. But in 2015, when I was leaving graduate school, there were almost no crypto companies that were really mature enough to be hiring people with econ and policy backgrounds. You had a few firms here and there that were doing it, but certainly not to the scale that you had today, as most people were still only hiring engineers, designers, and to some extent, business folks. Coincidentally, at the same time, I had some contacts at the Fed through my alumni network who were quite familiar with my background and my skill set and were starting to look at crypto for the first time. That said, it was like not really the like popular, exciting thing that everyone at the Fed wanted to work on. And I was able to use that as to my advantage, come in with an interest and some knowledge of crypto, and really take ownership of a few big projects at an early stage when there were really three or four people in the entire institution that that were working on them. By the time I left in the middle of summer 2022, there were probably hundreds of people who at various points of their day had to interact with crypto in a research or policy perspective. And a lot of people, especially from the economics community and the economics research community, are genuinely really interested in the space. These are people who've spent their entire careers studying financial markets, studying human behavior, geopolitics, you name it. And a lot of what they do involves studying a world that is so big and so complex, it can be very difficult to really engage with as a researcher. Whereas the crypto world is almost like we're running thousands of little experiments on different topics, from market design to governance to international payments, and you get a resolution of data and of experimentation that you just can't get in the real world. Though I'm sure there are economists at the Fed and elsewhere that would love to see if you could imagine what a new exchange model for U.S. equities looks like, but just really can't do it because some of the old systems are so deeply entrenched and so hard to really penetrate.
Did you work on, I guess, like the big project or... Yeah, like the biggest project that the Fed could possibly lead is a CBDC. Were you a part of that kind of that research?
So in the early days, I was a part of the analytical research to think about a CBDC from a purely design perspective. So this was not really involving any actual development of pilots or proofs of concept, but more thinking about conceptually what a CBDC would look like domestically, but also in conjunction with a few other international regulators. And we published a report in, I think, 2017 on this topic through the CPMI, which is a Basel committee type organization that does international financial diplomacy. And in the early days, it was a lot of really tiresome, meandering conversations about how you would define a CBDC and like debates over whether or not we already had one. Because if you look at central bank reserves that people just hold as Fed wire balances, those already are central bank money and they exist in digital form. So according to some definitions, we already have a CBDC and have had one for quite some time. From there, of course, there are a lot of other questions about design and its implications that I was kind of tangentially involved in.
Super interesting. And then I guess you had always been interested in crypto. So when... You know, you had the opportunity, you just made the jump to Paradigm, right?
Yeah, I had always been interested and felt like in the early days, it was quite easy to stay on top of crypto developments within the government. This is when most of crypto was considered a new type of money or a new way to make payments. At least that's the simplest heuristic for kind of thinking about what people thought it might be good for in the days of just Bitcoin and I think pre-ICO boom and DeFi summer. It was really around DeFi summer where I felt like the pace of innovation in the private sector started to get too difficult to really keep up with from my role in a government institution, where the barriers to really owning crypto and experimenting with crypto are too high. And it felt like it was a good time to make a switch. And I've always taken more of a hands-on approach to work and education, and felt like there was a good synergy there with Paradigm and its ethos as a venture capital firm that like doesn't just invest in companies, but actually builds protocols and tools for crypto users.
So at Paradigm, like, what are the major policy actions or initiatives that you guys are pushing? Like, what are you advocating for the most right now?
So, I mean, we try to take a long view of things overall and try to think about what policies might create an environment that allows crypto to grow and thrive the most over the next 5 to 10 years. And that's like really one of our core anchors. I think with that broad perspective, there's a couple of things that we kind of care deeply about. One is base layer neutrality and the idea that crypto's base layer infrastructure layer should stay credibly neutral and should be treated as more akin to a general purpose communications technology like the internet than something that is directly financial in nature. And so with respect to that, this is kind of our view that base layer participants such as validators or others involved in transaction processing and bundling should not necessarily be thought of as financial actors, where some policy recommendations that have come out would require all of the different market microstructure participants like validators, builders, searchers, et cetera, to make decisions about the transactions that they're processing and exert some kind of discretion over which ones to process and which ones not to process, which we think kind of violates a core tenet of crypto's neutrality and one of the things that makes decentralized systems really great. Another that I bucket into that category is just developer liability and creating systems that allow developers to develop and deploy code without needing to be fearful that illicit use of that code then places liability or responsibility on the developers, even if they had no part in the illicit activity that was conducted using their own code. And I think these are things that we feel kind of deeply about being necessary in order to create an environment that allows crypto to thrive and allows crypto to thrive in the US for the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay, so I guess the main goals that as Paradigm you're looking for is to really just set the groundwork for the industry to be able to flourish and to grow without being limited by, you know, by the concern that you might be sued or go to jail or need to spend a huge amount of money registering for, you know, something that many crypto protocols just cannot even comply with. So that makes sense. So it's about kind of laying that just like basic playing field, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
How do you think in the U.S. at least this is going? Like, what are some of the actions by regulators that, you know, have have signaled that the playing field is friendly or not? Like, do you think that that so far there is that environment where people can build freely?
I mean, I don't think that it's great. It is definitely the case that there have been some benefits that we've received from regulators not doing too much too soon. So, for example, it would have been probably premature for Congress to pass any crypto legislation in 2012, particularly when there was just an entire segment of the market and multiple segments that we couldn't even really envision at that point in time. And I think we have benefited from a lack of regulation, which has allowed us to innovate and create a lightweight regulatory perimeter that lets builders focus on building without necessarily having to spend a ton of money in upfront licensing or compliance costs. That said, I think we're probably well beyond the point where the lack of regulatory clarity on a couple of key issues has been helpful. And it's, I think, trending in the direction of just being like downright challenging, especially if you take it into the broader context of what's going on in other jurisdictions. So one of the major fights that we're still having here is with the SEC regarding the definition of a security, or to put it like in a colloquial way, when is a token not a security? The other regulators in other places like Europe and the UK have taken a much different approach, where they've at least attempted to carve out room for tokens to not be securities and to be issued as non-securities under a set of disclosures and guidelines that I think are understandable and reasonable for entrepreneurs. And we're just like light years away from that, even though there are certainly problems and challenges with the approach that is being taken in other jurisdictions. It at least in terms of process and the overall direction of travel, it's completely opposite from what we see here. And really starting to kind of feel it, where if you talk to a lot of crypto entrepreneurs, one of the number one things that they ask about or flag as a key concern is whether or not they're going to be legally liable for doing something wrong. And even if they want to comply with the law in good faith, they're just not able to do so because it's not clear, or it's just impossible to actually comply with.
Do you think that's the main, like the key thing that's missing in the US?
I think it's definitely one of the key ones. I think there are a lot of problems with the overall public policy engagement process, where we've arrived at a place that doesn't encourage the public sector to engage with the private sector in a deliberate and earnest way. And I mean, that really hurts the public sector's ability to write regulations that I think could potentially power a wave of innovation here in the US.
As an investor, like for Paradigm, how do you go about evaluating that risk when you have, so many startups based in the US, and they maybe you're coming across really promising projects, but there still is that kind of looming question of whether they'll be able to issue a token if they need to, or if it makes sense for their project.
Yeah, I mean, that's like really something that our investment team spends a ton of time focusing on, and something that we interface closely with them on the policy side, where we feel like we can be helpful. I do think in general, the US is still a place with some of the deepest engineering talent and some of the deepest and most liquid financial markets. So despite big headwinds and a lot of regulatory uncertainty, it is a place where a lot of builders want to be. I just worry and kind of stay up at night sometimes thinking about us potentially losing some international competitiveness to other jurisdictions that are being a lot more active and a lot more forward-leaning when it comes to engaging with the private sector and specifically with crypto companies.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard on this podcast, like a couple of people have said, founders have said, you need to be crazy to be building in crypto in the US. Do you agree with that? I guess, I mean, you're seeing there's still interest, but as someone, looking at regulation and policy, would you recommend that if you're starting a company, start it somewhere else?
I don't necessarily know if I would go that far. I think one of the things that we just don't know about is all of the companies that don't get started because people are concerned. So we like kind of see the ones that get built. We see the ones that get built overseas. We don't see the ones that could have been built if the founder felt like it was like a more permissible environment. And I think it's impossible to quantify how large a group that really is, but you definitely get the perception that like there are people out there that are fearful. And it's something that we like repeatedly try to communicate to policymakers that we kind of feel like as time progresses, more and more people are going to be spending more time online in digital spaces and in digital communities. Crypto is the obvious infrastructure for a lot of digital activity in the future, whether it be commerce, community, or something else entirely. And it's, in a lot of ways, I think, neglectful to look at how digitally native communities can be domiciled anywhere and they can locate wherever they want to, and not actively try to recruit them, to your local jurisdiction. So we really hope that policymakers start to wake up and realize that there are there's potential for jobs to be lost and for critical technology to be developed outside of the US, which is something that policymakers here should be caring about.
Definitely. So you talked about some of the biggest policies that a paradigm is concerned about, base layer neutrality and developer liability. So how in practice, like how are you pushing for those things to be favorable to crypto?
So primarily through two avenues, which is how we tend to do a lot of our offensive policy work. One is through research and writing. On the base layer neutrality point, we wrote a paper last year, right after the Tornado Cash OFAC designation, that laid out our legal arguments for why we didn't think that that was the right approach. We've also supported a lot of activities through the court system by filing amicus briefs and taking offensive legal action where we feel like we can support individual cases that might set bad precedent for the industry as a whole. And we're always looking for ideas and ways to help support these causes, even kind of beyond those two specific avenues.
In what cases have you been, not involved in is the word, right? But like, have you written opinions?
Yeah, so I'm actually not the best person to speak to that as a humble economist and only a pretend lawyer. my colleague Rodrigo Sierra is leading the charge on a lot of the legal work, and we've created a section of our Policy Lab website actually that lists all of the cases that we've recently been engaged in, includes some of the prominent ones that have been cropping up over the past year or so. Uki DAO, for one, Coinbase, there's several Coinbase ones, Ripple, and so on to give you a flavor.
Ether.fi is a non-custodial liquid staking protocol focused on providing the most secure path to maximizing rewards in the Ethereum staking ecosystem. Your ETH can be staked and then restaked to earn you the best rewards, all while maintaining composability for DeFi applications. Not your keys, not your coins.
And so you mentioned Policy Lab. What's that about?
So this was really the response to over a year of working and building the policy team and trying to find what we thought was our specific expertise and where we could use our skill set to be most beneficial to the crypto industry as a whole. At the conclusion of a really busy year, we decided to double down on the existing work that we've been doing in the form of legal advocacy, research and writing, and also expand our activities into two new areas. One is an academic fellowship program where we've given two fellowships to scholars. One is an economist at Columbia University. The other is a legal scholar at Harvard University, who are going to be studying the topic of regulatory equivalence, which is the idea that you can achieve the same regulatory outcome or the same policy outcome through legal means or technological means. And the, I think, easiest base case example to think about there is something like a traditional financial market exchange where the exchange and its rules are governed by a set of laws or contracts that participants agree to off-chain in the legal system, compared to something like a decentralized exchange where people are interacting with a system that is designed technically to operate in a certain way and designed to produce a similar outcome from a technical perspective. So we thought that funding academics to look at this topic could help increase the rigor and overall quality of crypto research, which is oftentimes sorely lacking.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so Policy Lab is funding people to study specific areas of research that will advance crypto in some way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in addition to the academic fellowship program, which is more targeted to academic researchers affiliated with universities or think tanks, we also launched something called the Research Hub, which is meant for researchers of any background and any affiliation to study much smaller, discrete questions that we think might be relevant for crypto policymakers. And here, what we really wanted to do was tap the talent of the open source community, structure it almost like a bug bounty program, where we can, after hearing a policy question from someone in DC, post that question to the internet, attach a grant to it, and get someone who spends their time researching crypto on Dune or in their spare time as a crypto company employee or as a student, have them answer the question and provide funding for that, so that the questions that are most important to policymakers are the ones that are getting answered by the people who have the skills and context for answering those questions. Because we've experienced that a lot of policymakers might have a good sense of what questions to ask, but they don't necessarily have deep expertise in crypto, at least deep enough to really do the kind of analytical work or data work to get those questions answered. So we're trying to fill that gap to some degree.
Super interesting. How big are the bounties or grants?
So up to $5,000, but it sort of depends on the scope of the project. We imagine some might be as narrow as asking someone to figure out the dollar value of remittance payments in crypto between the US and Latin America. Others might be like, please write a report on the amount of jobs lost in each US state as a result of anti-crypto policies.
Did you already start with this?
We have already started, actually.
Oh, nice. What are some of the questions?
So we've posted a few on the Policy Lab website. One is what I just mentioned around jobs, which we've framed as the danger of the status quo. So if regulators don't try to create a little more regulatory clarity or don't start engaging with crypto companies in a better and more fair manner, what are the potential consequences in terms of jobs lost or technology lost? We've also put one out that is focused on legal technical definitions, and we've actually received a really compelling proposal there on trying to define settlement finality, which in the payments context refers to a legal point in time when a payment can no longer be reversed. There are people in the regulatory community who think that you can never define a legal point in time when a stablecoin payment cannot be reversed because of how permissionless blockchains come to consensus in a more probabilistic manner. And so before some of that language gets into regulation, we wanted to fund a research project that's looking at this in a more comprehensive manner. The last area where we've had some like really exciting interest involves more of an ethnographic approach, looking at the reasons why crypto natives are drawn to crypto communities and where people are finding a sense of belonging and civic engagement in crypto communities in a way that I think humanizes the crypto industry more broadly and makes it difficult for potential crypto skeptics or people who are bad faith critics to paint the entire industry as a collection of scammers and fraudsters. Definitely the case that there are already communities out there, particularly NFT communities, where people are meeting a good portion of their friends that they have regular social engagements with in these communities, and like oftentimes have never met them in person or might only see them in person a year after they meet them online at a conference. And if we're going to understand what crypto means to the future of humanity, I think we need to really spotlight what's going on in some of these communities and how people are interacting with them and using them to really find friendship and work towards some collective vision that they all share.
Oh, that's so interesting. I think it is a unique aspect of crypto, how these online communities are formed and sometimes, you know, genuine connections are made. I think, you know, maybe when you're in crypto for a long time, maybe you may tend to get a bit jaded by it because of so much of crypto is just driven by, you know, just making money, flipping coins and NFTs and so on. But it is true that there is something beyond that that, you know, sometimes happens. You know, I don't think it's always or generally the case, but I think there are groups of, you know, just like genuine friendships and just like that desire to maybe, yeah, belong to something bigger that people in crypto have, and maybe why they stick around besides, you know, just the desire to, you know, gamble sometimes.
Definitely. No, I think that's really well stated. And it's important to tell those stories too, because so often policymakers, especially skeptical ones, ask, what is the killer use case? Or they say crypto is a failure because it doesn't have a killer use case. But I think there's no way to measure the value of some of these communities, especially the smaller ones or the ones that are developed for a time delimited purpose around a specific thing or event. And I think if you really spend time in the industry and take time to appreciate the socio-cultural aspects of crypto, you start seeing all of these like very vibrant online spaces that people are already existing in that might only have 3 or 4 people sometimes, but have really been the focus of like some deep and enduring relationships. And I think it's easy to ignore those. And I think as people working in the policy space, there, you know, we need to spend time spotlighting all of that stuff, even though it's less sexy and less exciting than everything else that's going on.
Super interesting. Are those reports, like the answers to the questions posed in the policy labs, is that all available?
Yeah, so we have not yet received the like final work products for anything, as we just launched, but the plan is to publish everything that we end up funding. So we really want this to be an open source approach to crypto policy research. And we want to source ideas from the crypto community. We want to source answers from the crypto community. And we want to make both the ideas and the answers available for other people to use, so that if someone is trying to prepare a report on crypto or speaking at a crypto event, they can go to the policy lab, they can look up interesting research, and they can use that for whatever they're working on.
Awesome. Yeah, no, looking forward to using that myself. So I'm interested in on your thoughts on regulation for DeFi versus CeFi. To me, like that's like one of the most, you know, interesting questions in this space on the kind of regulation front. It's like for DeFi, should it be regulated? Can it be regulated? And then for CeFi, does CeFi deserve like a separate category, or is it just finance? Like, why, if like there's a centralized entity custodying people's money, why should it have a separate category than, you know, just a regular bank or a regular exchange?
Yeah, in the abstract, I think it's difficult to answer. At least the DeFi specific question, because I think it's going to depend on the specific market and the specific use case. I think it's probably unlikely that it will ever see critical financial market infrastructure operating entirely on DeFi in a permissionless way with almost zero regulation. I think that probably works for like a subset of DeFi. And I hope that like we're able to protect DeFi such that we can continue to build and experiment and create new and interesting DeFi protocols and products. But I do anticipate that at some point, what we'll see happening is regulated institutions will start using DeFi and porting over concepts from DeFi into a more regulated or more regulatorily compliant environment. We've already seen this a little bit in certain places. The Bank for International Settlements ran a project a few months back where they worked with the central banks of Singapore, France, and Switzerland, and used an automated market maker to facilitate cross-border FX payments. And they deployed it on an Ethereum testnet, but you had to be a permissioned user in order to trade the tokens that they had available. And I think we'll probably see more of that in the future, where regulated institutions are taking concepts from DeFi, deploying them on public blockchains, but having some whitelist type component to it so that they understand who's using them. I think it would be very problematic if that was the only thing that you could do, and that like the only way to access DeFi was to be on a whitelist. That would be very, very bad and something we would try to fight. But it's probably going to be the case that for certain markets and certain use cases, there is some light touch regulation there that's used. I do completely agree on the conundrum with respect to CeFi regulation, where a lot of the issues are potentially not unique to crypto, but are issues that you face in custody and kind of more generally in financial services. Whether you can address those all with existing law and regulation, or whether you need like an addendum to it to deal with some crypto specific issues, that's I think an interesting question that would be keen to research more. There certainly are some elements on the operational side with respect to public blockchains that like might require additional changes, but whether or not that necessitates an entirely new legal framework is a separate question.
So I guess one important distinction would be what you were talking about before, kind of the question mark on what tokens are or aren't securities. Like if these platforms are going to be trading tokens, and there's a question on kind of whether they are or not securities, then, you know, then if that's kind of a gray area, then these players are in this kind of limbo where they don't know whether they should register as an exchange because they're trading securities maybe, or if they even can. As I understand, it's been just like difficult to for those who have tried to even do that, right? So I guess like
yeah,
that's
almost impossible.
Yeah. So I think like it's like coming back to that point, like is that the like one of the main issues that are just making CeFi regulation so difficult that we just don't know like what they're trading, like how that's where legally they stand.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it. We have a very unique regulatory apparatus in the U.S. at least, with two market regulators and multiple banking regulators at the federal level, not to mention at the state level. And I think some of the problems that we're facing are just unique and more a function of the historical evolution of financial market policy and some of the politics behind that than anything else. It's really interesting to see the approach that like other countries have taken. Europe, for example, has categorized tokens in a few different categories and like, has effectively said that if you were previously a security, but you become a tokenized security, you fall under existing securities law. If you are a utility token, which they've defined as something entirely separate, then you fall under the new crypto regulation. So they have not linked the technological incarnation of the financial asset, the token, to a specific regulatory construct, and have allowed some flexibility so that utility tokens are thought of as a separate thing and require a separate set of disclosures and a separate set of requirements from the traditional financial markets.
It would be amazing to get, you know, even that, you know, just like some sort of framework to work with in the US.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, most of the people out there are good actors and they want to do the right thing. It's a real tragedy when they can't, and when they get called, you know, bad actors for doing something that's physically impossible. And I think it would be unfortunate if this continues for a while.
Yeah, for sure. Another super interesting topic on kind of the regulatory front is stablecoins, which, you know, you've definitely worked on and looked at closely. So would love your thoughts on that. Like, where do you think, stablecoins, how should regulation for stablecoins develop? Because they do live in this different plane, right, where they are pegged to, in most cases, the US dollar. They have this interaction with banks where they need to be backed by assets. And then there's this separate category, you know, algorithmic stablecoins or like crypto-backed stablecoins. You know, should regulation be different for kind of these different types of tokens?
Yeah, I think one thing that seems clear is that if a stablecoin issuer is making a promise to the stablecoin holder that the stablecoin will be worth a dollar at all times or redeemable for a dollar immediately under all conditions, that probably requires a different set of guardrails than something that has a more complicated stabilization mechanism, allows it to float against the dollar in a less rigid way and may not guarantee redemption at any point in time, which I think would more like accurately characterize what are commonly like referred to as algorithmic stablecoins. But so I think they're like absolutely two different things. And the same regulatory approach probably doesn't work for both. I think in terms of algorithmic stablecoins, just making sure that the holders of those stablecoins understand that there are different risks is probably, or at least should be, like a cornerstone of any regulatory approach there. For fiat-backed stablecoins that do guarantee redemption, I think it's really important that we try to make the ecosystem as competitive as possible. And in doing so, we definitely don't want to enshrine certain incumbents, whether those be banks or large tech companies, to basically like get a monopoly over the stablecoin industry and end up kind of ruling the world. So I hope that regulators kind of approach the stablecoin question with that in mind. They, to the extent that they regulate, they do so in a way that allows for multiple types of stablecoins, including algorithmic ones, and appreciate that different types of stablecoins have different risks. And then they don't create such a rigorous and stringent set of requirements for stablecoin issuers that you can only do it if you're a really massive company to begin with. Because that would, I think, move us further away from stablecoins as a more equitable and useful digital payment instrument and closer to stablecoins as just another product that your bank might offer to you, which might not necessarily be the best thing for people overall.
Yeah. So what are some of those very kind of onerous requirements that you think could be, you know, placed on stablecoin issuers?
Yeah. So like for a while, people were talking about requiring stablecoin issuers to be insured depository institutions, effectively banks, which would require them to have bank charters. And today that means if you already have one, you could potentially be a stablecoin issuer, or you could apply to get a bank charter. There are a few different routes for doing that. But if you look at bank charter approval over the past 10 years, there's been almost zero creation of new bank charters.
Wow.
So like by requiring stablecoin issuers to become banks, unless there were pretty significant overhauls in the like charter approval process that required everyone to get a fair look, you would more or less restrict the universe of stablecoin issuers to existing insured depository institutions, which would be like, quite challenging. Or like you could potentially acquire a bank that already has a charter, which is very costly. I think post charter, there's just a host of regulations that banks have to follow around capital and liquidity requirements that are expensive and complicated and probably not well suited for the types of risks that a stablecoin issuer would face. So in addition to it being expensive to become a bank or acquire a bank, the ongoing maintenance of a bank is pretty costly by itself. So there would just be a ton of overhead that wouldn't necessarily be commensurate with the level of risk that stablecoin issuers would face. And I think that would significantly stifle the universe of stablecoin issuers and lead to a world where you only had a few pretty big, pretty protected players that were the only ones in town.
Is that in the cards at all?
Some of the legislative proposals that have been floating around have contemplated whether or not like you would need to be a depository institution. The president's working group published a report a few years back in 2021, I believe, that listed the requirement to be a bank as one of the core policy recommendations of the financial regulatory community. So there's definitely a time where the consensus view among regulators was that stablecoins are a new form of private money and they need to be under the domain of the federal banking regulators. And the way to do that would be to require them to be banks in the first place. I think there's a much like cleaner way to house them potentially under the authority of the federal banking agencies or a state banking regulator without requiring them to necessarily become a bank and have a bank charter and follow the broader framework for banking regulation by just creating a new charter pathway or a special purpose charter that was just dedicated towards these types of institutions, which are not doing the complicated maturity transformation that requires the whole suite of banking regulations, but are like much closer to a payments institution and could potentially have a lighter touch set of regulations, especially the ones that aren't very large to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds like it'd be it'd be so bad for the industry as a whole if stablecoin issuers were required to be banks. So hopefully you and everyone, I mean, Paradigm and, you know, everyone else like advocating for crypto can, you know, can avoid that. And, you know, on still a bit on stablecoins, I guess like one major issue is the reserve transparency. And I think that kind of links to what you mentioned before about how technology can be sometimes used in a better way than legislation or than, you know, just like regulatory requirements to achieve the same goal. How open do you think lawmakers are to realizing this about stablecoin reserves, that there is, you know, that blockchains can help prove how well a stablecoin is collateralized in the case of crypto-backed stablecoins? Like, is that something that they are analyzing or willing to, you know, to take into account?
Like, probably not enough. I mean, I used to joke that a lot of the regulatory community was concerned about stablecoins being a risk vector for the treasury market, which is today predominantly the kind of reserve asset of choice for a lot of the large fiat-backed stablecoins. But I would joke that I thought the biggest potential risk to stablecoins was actually reliance on the treasury market, which is operationally not great. It is structurally not great and has broken down at several points over the past few years. And with some of these stablecoins, you have a very rickety set of traditional financial rails, on top of which you're building crypto products that are tradable 24/7 on infrastructure that never closes. So on one hand, you have very old infrastructure that doesn't work all the time and has all these weird rules about when it's open. And on the other side, you have an unstoppable computer. And I think if you like actually look at crypto collateralized stablecoins, you don't have that problem because the reserve collateral is natively issued or natively created on the exact same technological infrastructure as the coin or token that it's backing. So not only do you have like the visibility, but on the operational side, it's always open and always operable. So I think there's a lot of room to potentially explore crypto collateralized stablecoins. I think the over-collateralized ones have a bad reputation among regulators for not being capital efficient. The under-collateralized ones have a bad reputation for several of the kind of notable or prominent collapses that they've faced. I think in a few years, we'll probably come up with new designs that get us closer and closer to the holy grail. But there's a real risk that regulators take a more aggressive approach today and enshrine existing models that we know about, or potentially prevent certain models from being created. And I think we really need to try to preserve the ability for people to experiment and try new things, especially where it's done in a way that's smaller scale at first and like eventually larger once we've battle tested things.
I think, you know, that framework can be applied to so much in crypto. I mean, the fact that regulators should be using the technology to achieve the same goals they have in a much more efficient way. It's a shame that they're not, like.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it seemed like a few years ago we were potentially going to see more of that, but there's been a breakdown, I think, over the past 3 or 4 years. And hopefully, I think by conducting more research and elevating more of the voices that are really building to the problems that regulators are trying to solve, I think we can get to a place. And I think there are a lot of people in the regulatory community that are like quite interested in the space and quite open to learning from people that are out there.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay, and then to wrap up, what are some of the key developments in the regulatory front that are coming up next year that we should watch out for? I don't know, any kind of big legislation that's going to be discussed? Like, yeah, what are some of the main headlines?
Two biggest ones are just on the legislative front for stablecoins, and then for market structure more generally. There's a handful of bills that would cover each that have been discussed. We got relatively close, or at least as close as we've ever gotten before, to passing a market structure bill. And I think we're looking to potentially build on that momentum next year. Wouldn't surprise me if something happened, but you never know with the way things operate in DC.
All right. Well, we just have to be optimistic that there are, like you said, I mean, most people do have good intentions. There are some smart people in Washington when it comes to crypto. All we need to do is just, you know, get those people to speak the loudest, convince everyone else. And so I think, you know, the work of policy advocates, professionals in crypto are, you know, the one of the main ways to do that. So, great chatting. And again, super excited to keep track of the policy lab. I'll be definitely checking that out. And yeah, thanks. Thanks again for coming.
Yeah, definitely. This is great. Look forward to sharing all the things that the policy lab is working on in future conversations.